Love your weekend breakfast
with Refilwe Mbakanyane on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
We are walking the talk indeed, and the talk right now is, you know, exploring and having those much needed conversations, uncomfortable for some, but conversations that also shed light into, you know, the aspirations of South Africans and the various ways in which they express themselves, they live their lives and explore happiness. Khosi Jian is our clinical psychologist, and I always enjoy talking to her on a Sunday morning as we just explore what it is to be a human being trying to live and live well. Khosi, good morning.
Wintre, good morning to you, and happy Mother's Day to you and the listeners.
Thank you so much, Khosi. Today, we're taking a look at the fact that the country's marriage laws could, in the near future, allow women to marry more than one husband, just as polygamous men can have many wives. Just tell us more about that legislation on polyandry and what it's essentially proposing.
Right. So the legislation seeks to rectify historical bias. And as many of us may well be aware, and this is not my forte at all, but a teaspoon worth of words that I can say about it is that, you know, a lot of the legal infrastructure in South Africa has been inherited as South Africa is a colonial outpost. You know, it has been inherited from the Euro-Western, you know, legal framework. And I guess where we are as a country right now is we are, you know, wrestling with how to rectify those biases that sit in the legal framework. And currently, the intention is really to create equality in marriage, and hence these proposals around the Marriage Act that are looking at all these biases that are inherent in the current system.
Yeah, so of course, you know, the Department of Home Affairs saying they really want to allow everyone in the country to conclude recognized legal marriages. So that brings us then to understanding and talking about the business of polyandry. What is polyandry? What does it look like? Because, of course, I did say, you know, in my opening statement that it could allow South African women to take more than one husband. But, of course, does it necessarily have to be a man?
Yeah, it doesn't. And polyandry, you know, the principle behind it, it rests on the principle of polyamory. You know, the word being poly means many, and amor comes from the Latin word amor, which is love, right? And the principle behind it is that there's more than one kind of love, there's more than enough love to give and to share amongst all humanity, and it challenges the idea of love as contained and circumscribed, as we have seen, you know, that marriage says, forsaking all others, I choose, you know, to devote and give all of this to just one person, right? Which is what monogamy is about. So what polyandry is saying is that it's opening that space. And there's three related words that we want to clarify and speak to. So as you cited, you know, there's been polygamy, which is the more recognized after monogamy, that men are allowed to have more than one wife. Mm-hmm. And currently, as I did some research on this, it states that there are 58 out of 200 sovereign states, majority of which are Muslim in Africa and in Asia, that recognize polygamy, right? And then there's also polygyny, which is also has often been used interchangeably with polygamy. Mm-hmm. However, what the current proposals are looking to do is to separate into three distinct categories. Polygamy, which refers to one wife, more than one wife, and polyandry, to speak to more than one husband. And then polygyny, to speak to, you know, gender-neutral marriage, which says that, for example, females can have more than one female partner.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Right? So it seeks to expand the landscape. And I dare say, you know, it just says that society we are navigating and wrestling multiple and competing discourses around, you know, relationality in this country.
Yeah. It's I guess something to sort of wrap your mind around about, you know, the mechanics of all of this. We think we know, or we think we've established how monogamy should work, as you said, forsaking all others. But even within that, people are, you know, negotiating boundaries and ways of being in ways that suit them. But, you know, for a sort of working definition, when we talk about polyandry, forsake all others forsake all others to be with you two or you three or you four. Everybody has to agree to this union, to the mechanics of it, to the boundaries, the details of it. You know, how in a perfect world do we navigate polyandry? What does it look like?
I guess the principle, and it's not clear at this stage in terms of, apparently it's a 67-page document, and I'm not sure what the mechanics of it are as a green paper at the moment. But I suppose that the principles of monogamy will kind of guide the way forward, in the sense that, you know, it has to be recognized. Hence, when you see in wedding ceremonies or marriage ceremonies, the question is, there anyone who objects to this? And very often, sometimes, the worms come out from under the ground and say, yes, I do object, because I am actually the wife, and so on. Equally so, as we've moved more towards polygamy, the understanding has been that there should be consent, right? Sure. And I think, for example, around in the U.S., where there are areas where there is polygamy, and I think there's a show called Sister Wives, where they talk about, in the opening of that show, they always talk about, I didn't just want one person, I wanted a whole system, a whole family, right? Mm. So there is that common understanding amongst them, that they need the permission of these wives to open the space for another one to come into the system. So my suspicion is that polyandry will work around the same principle, to say that the existing husband has to consent to a second husband, and so on. And similarly with polygyny, that it can't be a secret arrangement, because then it's an affair, isn't it? And all these yandries and polygyny are suggesting that this should be recognized, and therefore on the table and open and agreed upon by the participants in that system.
Yeah. Often, you know, when people talk about why this type of union appeals to them, you've spoken about, you've cited sort of more the Mormon religion and the idea that, you know, these women say, I didn't just want to marry a person, I wanted a system, a structure that works for me. But, you know, people often cite things like, well, you know, what I can get something from from this partner that I don't necessarily get from another partner. And we do sort of complement each other's needs, each other's strengths and weaknesses. What other sort of emotional or personal reasons also come into play for why this union is favorable for some people?
Well, you know, people are saying there's fluidity in love, there's fluidity in relationality, and it's preposterous to actually just contain. And even the fact that there is that attempt in society to contain and circumscribe it to one person, reality has proved over and over that there is more to, relations and relationality than just the one. And this is, you know, people will cite different species beyond the human species that just show that, you know, it is more than possible for us to spread love and relations to more than one person. And that it often, you know, suffocates, as you were saying, one person, to put this burden of responsibility on the one person. But of course, I think the premise of monogamy, if you go back to it, it rests very much on the principle of evolutionary, right? The evolutionary principle and mate selection strategy that says, you know, the most basic function of human beings is to propagate the species, right? And it takes one man to propagate with more than one woman. And that physiologically, the man is endowed with the physical strength to provide and protect the women, who then are the ones that are the carriers of the man's gene pool. And men will choose and should be allowed to choose amongst the best, the strongest, however those are defined within a certain social cultural context. of what defines the best woman, and that the strongest men will propagate themselves with the strongest women, and thereby enhance the survival of the species, right? So that's just one discourse around it.
Yeah.
And of course, it evolves, and there are many other competing discourses.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting to read that, you know, in putting together this, green paper on marriages, Home Affairs, you know, they hosted some dialogues in 2019 and 2020. And, you know, various people, from traditional leaders to religious leaders to academics and gender activists and people from the LGBTQIA plus community were also, you know, present in those meetings. And, you know, what they were looking to do was create new marriage regimes that could bring about equality in marriage laws, but also that could be culture neutral, right? Or accommodate everybody's needs. When we look at it from a child's perspective, a child growing up in a polyandrous marriage, what could be the benefits? I mean, quite often, Corsi, let's see if we can get Corsi back on the line. The line has just dropped. I wanted to ask Corsi, you know, quite often we throw around and we use the term, it takes a village, you know, to raise a child. It takes not just the parents, the nuclear family. It takes, you know, the entire neighborhood. It takes the extended family. It takes school, society to raise this child and to bring them up into a responsible adult who contributes towards society. I wonder, Corsi, now that we've got you back on the line, are you there?
I'm here. I'm feeling
all right.
The last I heard is you were saying what was interesting in putting together this, I think, this research piece or this discussion.
Ah, okay. So, you know, I was just alluding to us getting to the fact that we often throw around the term, it takes a village to raise a child. And I wonder what the benefits in a polyandrous relationship might be for children born into this kind of union. Because, you know, with more parents and more perspectives and essentially more hands on deck in the nuclear family, what might be the benefits for a child?
Yeah, so there's more love on deck, right? And if we take the idea of the nucleus, the nucleic family of mother, father, right? And if we look at what the psychological landscape suggests around attachment and so on, around the one mother and the one father being the attachment figures of the child, and what then ensues in terms of what deficiency looks like between just those two, as contrasted with what I refer to as more collectivistic societies, where children have a lot more pool of resources to nurture and support and look after them, and where parents compensate for each other's deficiencies, you know, the assumption being all of us are perfectly imperfect, and where one lacks, the other is there. And for example, they may have different strengths to bring. One may have more financial resources to bring, which are part of the resources that the family has to share amongst the children, whereas another is perhaps more the nurturer, you know, who will be the homekeeper. And they then complement each other in that way, raising more healthy you know, families than those that hinge on just the two, you know, the pigeon pair parents, as it were.
Well, we've got some voice notes that have come through, and let me just play the first one here. Just take a listen to this, Corsi.
I'm not looking for, I'm not getting involved in such a messy business. One woman is a hard business as it is. Now you're going to share the responsibility of one woman with another man. Unless you like that, it's in your head. You can have swingers party, go and swing and come back to reality. That is like going out to play and coming, but to get married, no. Not married, because you have to have a family. And what type of a family will that be?
Huh, interesting.
Because a man needs to have a house and a woman. It's understandable with a woman. A woman can have a separate house. Houses. How will those two men have? They will have a separate houses. Then, hey, this can't work. It's not. It's never going to work. I don't know how it works overseas, but as long as the woman is able to look after herself, maybe it can work, but not being supported by both men, competing for love of one man, a woman. I'm not going to do that.
I'm stifling my chuckle. Thanks so much for
quite
that voice note.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, it is quite an emotive matter and quite an emotive topic, right? But you hear that essentially he's worried about the, you know, having to fight for affection, and you know, surely in this kind of arrangement, you all come to it and agree to it because it's something that you can handle. But I guess the contesting or fighting for affection or attention happens in a, you know,
in any
relationship, whether or not it's just a marriage between two individuals.
Absolutely. And I think people, you know, are not often aware. We are more so sensitized and aware to polygamy than we are to polyandry. But it is being practiced and has been practiced, you know, over the ages by different societies. I mean, I remember speaking to two scholars recently, two professors, both of whom cited, you know, that in Kemet, which is ancient Egypt, it's always been known as, you know, to be practiced. Tibetans in Nepal practice it, parts of India and parts of China, it is practiced there. And interestingly, that it is often brothers who marry one woman, and it may be more than one brother who marry and share all access to this woman. And so it speaks to how we are scripted as society, and how when we arrive and have bought into one script, it is difficult for us to mentally make space for other scripts. And it is that wrestle, I guess, that we struggle with.
Yeah, really, really interesting. We've got a call on the line. Let's head to Bongani. Welcome to Weekend Breakfast, Bongani. Thanks so much for calling in. What's your question or your comment?
No, I just want to make a statement. You know, me personally, I'm against what this law is proposed from a moral point of view, and also from looking at how. Because a lot of the things that we get we get to do is because of how we look at how animals live and all of that. And you can see in animal life, the male is the head and the female is. Not that I'm saying that women are not capable of doing anything. Women have gone through many things over the years, and they've actually gone to a point where they're actually quite advanced as compared to what happened in the past. And then I just also want to make one more comment to say that, look,
Bongani,
in South Africa, yes.
Where in the animal kingdom are you looking to the idea that men are the heads of this a family unit? Or
it's like you can even see it with lions, you can see it with elephants, and even with elephants, you get the matriarch. She's in charge, but then the male is there to protect and all of that.
Okay.
You don't get two male lions, two male heading the family.
How does that inform your concerns?
I just make one more statement, one more important thing. In South Africa, we're already struggling with gender-based violence. And you have seen over the last few weeks, there have been bullying incidents where the one kid is being bullied and everybody stands and just watches. Now, you can imagine the situation where, you know, in households where this woman is now being attacked by the one partner. And yes, maybe the other partners might just stand and watch, or maybe the other partners might be able to defend her. You'll never know what happened. But I think before we start going into these types of marriages and all of that, let's first start sorting out things like gender-based violence. Then maybe we can start looking at other things, because
all right, Bongani, time. I'm not sure I follow Bongani's thread or train of thought there, Kosi.
You know, I think the counter argument could be presented that, mm-hmm. you know, part of the gender-based violence is the very principle that men think they are the ultimate owners and the ultimate head.
Or the head of a household and the decision maker.
Yeah, and absolutely. And polyandry might just sharpen that edge. So it could go either way.
All right. Okay, Bongani, thanks for calling in. Let's play a final voice note before we leave it. Let's see. Let's listen out. Brady, I'm not sure why this message, well, we're not hearing the audio. Can you just help us out there?
Pays lobola. My question is, who pays lobola? To who? and won't this exacerbate the issue of women abuse? Because if I've paid my lobola, I will be entitled to that individual, and somebody else comes with the lesser lobola. It will create a lot of problems, in my take, Bilal.
All right. Somehow we're
again.
Yeah.
And he uses the word entitles, right? And it sounds like it's beyond him to imagine that polyandry will still entitle you within that pool. It's as if it lessens your entitlement. And it's just this idea of, you know, the sole man in this person's life and lobola being the currency that buys you that, you know, exclusivity.
It's quite interesting, of course, how we even frame or view relationships. There's the sense of ownership. There's a sense of what your rights to a to time, to a person's body, to a person's affections. And their attention. It's quite interesting how we frame these things. And we, you know, there's no sense that relationships are an oasis, right? A reprieve from the rest of the world, somewhere where you go to fill your cup or you get inspired.
Sanctuary, your emotional and psychological sanctuary.
Sure.
Absolutely.
So I think that probably leads us to, we'll have to unpack, you know, the comments that came through towards the end of our conversation here, and we'll have to maybe do a part two of this conversation and just unpack how we actually view relationships and frame relationships as a society. And then, of course, talk about gender-based violence and just old notions or patriarchal notions around relationships and exclusivity, because sure, we've got lots to talk about and start to understand. Well, thanks so much, Kosi, for bringing this conversation to us on this Sunday morning. Look forward to next week. I think I'm going to have to bank a lot of these voice notes that we couldn't get to, and we'll utilize them in our chat. Kosi, keep well. Until then, that's our clinical psychologist, Kosi Gyanem.